Chapter 26. As if the world were fog. Toy set a fast pace through the forest, but Tuan rode close behind him, with Seleucia at her side, of course, so she could listen in on him and Talmanis. Her own thoughts interfered with eavesdropping, however. So he had grown up with the dragon reborn, had he? The dragon reborn. And he had denied knowing anything at all of the man. That was one lie of his she had failed to catch, and she was good at catching lies. In Shandar, the undetected lie might be the one that killed you, or sent you to the sail block as property. Had she known of his prevarication, she might have slapped his face, rather than allowing him to kiss her. Now that had been a shock, one she was not sure she had recovered from yet. Seleucia had described being kissed by a man, but the actuality made the other woman's descriptions pale. No, she had to listen. "You left Estion in charge?" Toy erupted, so loudly that a covey of grey doves burst from cover in the thin undergrowth with a mournful whirring sound. "The man's a fool!"
"Not too much of a fool to listen to Daerid," Talmanis replied calmly.
He did not seem a man to get overly excited. He kept a careful watch, head swiveling constantly. Every so often he scanned the sky through the thick branches overhead, too. He had only heard of Rakan, yet he watched for them. His words were even crisper and quicker than Toy's, and difficult to follow. These people all spoke so fast.
"Carloman and Ryman are not fools, Matt. At least Ryman is only a fool sometimes. But neither will they listen to a commoner, no matter how much more he knows about warfare than they do. Edorian will, but I wanted him with me."
That red hand symbol Talmanis wore was intriguing, more than intriguing, much more. Of an old and distinguished house, was he? But Toy was the one. He remembered Hawkwing's face. That seemed utterly impossible, yet his denial of it had plainly been a lie, as plain as the spots on a leopard. Could the red hand be Toy's sigil? But if so, what about his ring? She'd almost fainted when she first saw that. Well, she had come as close to it as she had since childhood.
"That's going to change, Talmanis," Toy growled. "I let it go on too long as it is. If Ryman and the others command banners now, that makes them banner generals, and you a lieutenant general. Daerid commands 5 banners, and that makes him a lieutenant general too. Ryman and the others will obey his orders or they can go home. Come Tarman Gaiden, I'm not going to have my skull split open because they bloody refuse to listen to somebody who doesn't have bloody estates."
Talmanis turned his horse to ride around a patch of briars and everyone followed. The tangled vines seemed to have particularly long thorns and hooked besides.
"They will not like it, Matt, but they will not go home either. You know that. Have you any ideas yet how we are to get out of Altara?" "I'm thinking on it," Toy muttered. "I'm thinking on it. Those crossbowmen..." He exhaled heavily. "That wasn't wise, Talmanis. For one thing, they're used to marching on their own feet. Half of them will have all they can do to stay in the saddle if we're moving fast, and we're going to have to. They can be useful in woods like these or anywhere they have plenty of cover, but if we're on open ground with no pikes, they'll be ridden down before they can loose a second flight." In the distance, a lion coughed. In the distance. But it was still enough to make the horses whicker nervously and dance a few steps. Toy leaned forward on his gelding's neck and appeared to whisper in the animal's ear. It quieted immediately. So that had not been another of his fanciful tales after all. Remarkable. "I picked men who could ride, Matt," Talmanis said once his bay stopped frisking. "And they all have the new crank."
A touch of excitement entered his voice now. Even restrained men tended to warmth over weapons.
3 turns of the crank.
His hands moved in a quick circle, demonstrating.
"And the bowstring is latched. With a little training, a man can get off 7 or 8 quarrels in a minute. With a heavy crossbow."
Seleucia made a small sound in her throat. She was right to be startled. If Talmanis was telling the truth, and he had no reason to lie that Tuan could find, then she had to obtain one of these marvelous cranks somehow. With one for a pattern, artisans could make more. Archers could shoot faster than crossbowmen, but they took longer to train, too. There were always more crossbowmen than archers.
7?
Toy exclaimed incredulously.
That would be more than useful, but I never heard of such a thing. Ever. He muttered that as if it had some special significance, then shook his head. How did you come by it?
7 or 8. There was a mechanic in Murundi who wanted to take a wagon load of things he had invented up to Camelon. There is a school of some sort there for scholars and inventors. He needed money for the journey, and he was willing to teach the band's armorers to make the things. Smother your enemy with arrows at every opportunity. It is always better to kill your enemies far off than close at hand.
Seleucia held her hands up so Tuan could see them, slim fingers moving quickly. What is this band they speak of? She used the proper form, inferior to superior, yet her impatience was almost palpable. Impatience with everything that was happening. Tuan kept few secrets from her, but some seemed advisable for the present. She would not put it past Seleucia to return her to Ebu Dar forcibly, so she would not be breaking her word. A shadow's duties were many, and sometimes required paying the final sacrifice. She did not want to have to order Seleucia's execution. She replied in the imperative form, Toy's personal army, obviously. Listen, and we may learn more. Toy commanding an army seemed very odd. He was charming at times, even witty and amusing, but often a buffoon and always a rapscallion. He had seemed very much in his element as Thailand's pet. Yet he had seemed in his element among the show's performers, too, and with the Maroth Damani and the two escaped Damani, and in the Hell. That had been such a disappointment. Not even one fight. Events later had not compensated for that. Getting swept up in a street brawl was hardly the same as seeing fights in a hell, which admittedly had been far more boring than rumor heard in Ebu Dar had made it seem. Toy had displayed an unexpected side of himself in that street brawl, a formidable man, though with a peculiar weakness. For some reason she found that strangely endearing.
Good advice, he said absently, tugging at the black scarf tied around his neck.
She wondered about the scar he took such pains to hide. That he did was understandable. Why had he been hanged, and how had he survived? She could not ask. She did not mind lowering his eyes a little. In fact, it was enjoyable making him writhe. It took so little effort. But she did not want to destroy him. At least, not for the moment.
Do you not recognize it? Talmanis said. It is from your book. King Roadron has 2 copies in his library. He has it memorized. The man thinks it will make him a great captain. He was so pleased with how our bargain worked out that he had a copy printed and bound for me.
Toy gave the other man a mystified look.
My book? The one you told us about, Matt. Fog and Steel by Madoc Comadrin.
Oh, that book, Toy shrugged. I read it a long time ago. Tuan gritted her teeth, her fingers flashed. When will they stop talking of books and go back to interesting things? Perhaps if we listen we may learn more, Seleucia replied. Tuan glared at her, but the woman wore such an innocent look that she could not maintain her scowl. She laughed, softly, so as not to let Toy realize how close behind him she was, and Seleucia joined in, softly. Toy had fallen silent, though, and Talmanis seemed content to leave it so. They rode in silence, save for the sounds of the forest, birds singing, strange black-tailed squirrels chittering on branches. Tuan set herself to watching for omens, but nothing caught her eye. Bright-feathered birds darted among the trees. Once they spotted a herd of perhaps 50 tall, lean cattle with very long horns, that stuck out almost straight to either side. The animals had heard them coming and were squared up, facing them. A bull tossed his head and pawed at the ground. Toy and Talmanis led the careful way around the herd, keeping their distance. She looked over her shoulder. The Red Arms. Why were they called that? She would have to ask Toy. The Red Arms were leading the pack horses, but Gordoran had raised his crossbow and the others had arrows knocked to their bows. So these cattle were dangerous. There were few omens concerning cattle, and she was relieved when the herd dwindled behind them. She had not come all this way to be killed by a cow, or to see Toy killed by one.
After a time, Tom and Aludra came up to ride beside her. The woman glanced at her once, then looked straight ahead. The Tarabonner's face, framed by those brightly beaded braids, was always wooden when she looked at her or Seleucia. So clearly she was one of those who refused to accept the return. She was watching Toy, and she looked satisfied, as if something had been confirmed for her, perhaps. Why had Toy brought her along? Surely not for her fireworks. Those were pretty enough, but they could not compare with skylights performed by even a half-trained Damani. Tom Marilyn was much more interesting. Patently, the white-haired old man was an experienced spy. Who had sent him to Ebu Dar? The White Tower seemed the most obvious candidate. He spent little time around the three who called themselves Aes Sedai, but a well-trained spy would not give himself away in that fashion. His presence troubled her. Until the last Aes Sedai was leashed, the White Tower was something to be wary of. Despite everything, she still had troubling thoughts at times that somehow Toy was part of a White Tower plot. That was impossible, unless some of the Aes Sedai were omniscient, yet the thought sometimes came to her.
"A strange coincidence, wouldn't you say, Master Marilyn?" she said, "encountering part of Toy's army in the middle of an Altaran forest."
He stroked his long moustaches with a knuckle, failing to mask a small smile.
"He's Taviran, my lady, and you can never tell what will happen around a Taviran. It's always interesting when you travel with one of those. Matt has a tendency to find what he needs when he needs it. Sometimes before he knows he needs it."
She stared at him, but he seemed serious.
"He's tied to the pattern?"
That was how the word would translate.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
The old man's blue eyes widened in astonishment.
"You don't know? But it said Arthur Hawkwing was the strongest Taviran anyone had ever seen, perhaps as strong as Randall Thor. I'd have thought you, of all people, would..."
"Well, if you don't, you don't.
Taviran are people the pattern shapes itself around, people who were spun out by the pattern itself to maintain the proper course of the weaving, perhaps to correct flaws that were creeping in. One of the Aes Sedai could explain better than I."
As if she would have conversation with a Marath Damani. Or worse, a runaway Damani.
"Thank you," she told him politely. "I think I've heard enough."
Taviran. Ridiculous. These people and their endless superstitions. A small brown bird, surely a finch, flew out of a tall oak and circled Widdershins three times above Toy's head before flying on. She had found her omen. Stay close to Toy. Not that she had any intention of doing otherwise. She had given her word, playing the game as it had to be played, and she had never broken her word in her life. Little more than an hour after setting out, as a bird warbled ahead, Seleucia pointed out the first sentry, a man with a crossbow up in the thick branches of a spreading oak, cupping a hand to his mouth. Not a bird, then. More bird calls heralded their advance, and soon they were riding through a tidy encampment. There were no tents, but the lances were neatly stacked, the horses picketed on scattered lines among the trees, near to the blankets of the men who would ride them, with a saddle or pack saddle at every animal's head. It would not take long for them to break camp and be on the march. Their fires were small and gave off little smoke. As they rode in, men in dull green breastplates with that red hand on their coat sleeves and red scarves tied to their left arms began rising to their feet. She saw grizzled faces with scars and fresh young faces, all with their eyes on Toy and expressions she could only call eager. A growing murmur of voices rose, rustling through the trees like a breeze.
"It's Lord Matt! Lord Matt is back! Lord Matt's found us! Lord Matt!"
Tuon exchanged glances with Seleucia. The affection in those voices was unfeigned. That was rare, and often went with a commander who had a slack hand at discipline. But then she expected any army of Toys to be a ragtag affair, full of men who spent their time drinking and gambling. Only these men looked no more ragtag than any regiment that had crossed a mountain range and ridden several hundred miles. No one looked unsteady on his feet with drink.
"Mostly we camp during the day and move at night to avoid being seen by the Shonshan," Talmanis said to Toy. "Just because we have seen none of those flying beasts does not mean some might not be around. Most of the Shonshan seem to be farther north or farther south, but apparently they have a camp not 30 miles north of here, and rumor says there is one of the creatures there."
"You seem pretty well informed," Toy said, studying the soldiers they passed. He nodded suddenly, as if he had reached a decision. He seemed grim, and could it be resigned?
"I am that, Matt. I brought half the scouts, and I also signed some Altarans who were fighting the Shonshan. Well, most of them seemed to have been stealing horses more than anything else, but some were willing to give that up for a chance to really fight them. I think I know where most of the Shonshan camps are, from the Malvide Narrows south to here."
Suddenly a man began to sing in a deep voice, and others joined in, the song spreading rapidly.
"There's some delight in ale and wine, and some in girls with ankles fine, but my delight, yes, always mine, is to dance with Jack of the Shadows."
Every man in the camp was singing now, thousands of voices roaring the song.
"We'll toss the dice however they fall, and snuggle the girls, be they short or tall, then follow Lord Matt whenever he calls, to dance with Jack of the Shadows."
They finished with shouts, laughing and clapping one another on the shoulder. Who under the light was this Jack of the Shadows? Reining in, Toy raised the hand holding his odd spear. That was all, yet silence spread through the soldiers. So he was not soft with discipline. There were a few other reasons for soldiers to be fond of their officers, but the most common seemed unlikely to apply to Toy of all people.
"Let's not let them know we're here until we want them to know," Toy said loudly.
He was not orating, just making sure his voice carried. And the men heard, repeating his words over their shoulders to be passed back to men beyond the sound of his voice.
"We're a long way from home, but I mean to get us home. So be ready to move, and move fast. The Band of the Red Hand can move faster than anybody else, and we're going to have to prove it."
There was no cheering, but plenty of nods. Turning to Talmanis, he said,
"Do you have maps?"
"The best to be found," Talmanis replied. "The band has its own map maker now. Master Roy Dell already had good maps of everything from the Arith Ocean to the spine of the world, and since we crossed the Damonas, he and his assistants have been making new maps of the country we crossed. They even marked a map of Eastern Altara with what we have learned of the Shonshan. Most of those camps are temporary, though. Soldiers heading somewhere else."
Seleucia shifted in her saddle, and Tuon signed, "Patience," in high imperative form, a command. She kept her face smooth, but inside she was furious. Knowing where soldiers were gave clues to where they were going. There had to be some way to burn that map. That would be as important as laying hands on one of the crossbow cranks.
"I'll want to talk with Master Roydell, too," Toy said.
Soldiers came to take the horses, and for a while all seemed confusion and milling about. A gap-toothed fellow took Akain's reins, and Tuon gave him explicit instructions on caring for the mare. He returned her a sour look along with his bow. Commoners in these lands seemed to believe themselves equal to everyone. Seleucia gave the same sort of instructions to the lanky young man who took Rosebud. She thought that an appropriate name for a dresser's horse. The young man stared at Seleucia's chest until she slapped him, hard. He only grinned and led the dun away, rubbing his cheek. Tuon sighed. That was all very well for Seleucia, but for herself, striking a commoner would lower her eyes for months. Soon enough, though, she was settled on a folding stool with Seleucia at her back, and stout Lopin presented them with tin cups full of dark tea, bowing quite properly to Seleucia as well as to her. Not deeply enough, but the balding man did try. Her tea was honeyed to perfection, lightly, but then he had served her often enough to know how she liked it. Activity bustled about them. Talmanis had a brief reunion with gray-haired Nerim, who apparently was his serving man, and happy to be reunited with him. At least the thin man's normally mournful countenance actually flashed a momentary smile. That sort of thing should have been done in private. Lylwyn and Doman allowed Master Charon to lead Olvaroff to explore the camp with Juulin and Thera. Tom and Aludra went, too, to stretch their legs, then deliberately took stools close by. Lylwyn even went so far as to stare unblinking at Tuon for a long moment. Saluta made a low sound, very like a growl, but Tuon ignored the provocation and gestured Mistress Annan to bring her stool over beside her. Eventually the traitors would be punished, and the thief, the property restored to its rightful owners, and the Marath Damani leashed. But those things had to wait on what was more important. Three more officers appeared, young noblemen with that red hand on their dark silk coats, and had their own reunion with Toy, with a great deal of laughing and hitting each other on the shoulder, which they seemed to take as a sign of fondness. She soon had them sorted out. Adorian was the dark, lean man with the serious expression, except when smiling. Ryman, the broad-shouldered fellow who smiled a great deal, and Carloman, the tall, slender one. Adorian was clean-shaven, while Ryman and Carloman both had dark beards that were trimmed to points and glistened as if oiled. All three made much over the Aes Sedai, bowing deeply. They even bowed to Bethamin and Sita. Tuon shook her head.
"I've told you often enough it's a different world than you're used to," Mistress Annan murmured. "But you still don't quite believe it, do you?"
"Just because a thing is a certain way," Tuon replied, "doesn't mean it should be that way, even if it has been for a long time."
"Some might say the same of your people, my lady."
"Some might."
Tuon let it rest there, though she usually enjoyed her private conversations with the woman. Mistress Annan argued against leashing Marath Damani, as might be expected, and even against keeping Duck O'Vale of all things. Yet they were discussions rather than arguments, and Tuon had made her concede a few points. She had hopes of bringing the woman around eventually. Not today, though. She wanted her mind focused on Toy. Master Roydell appeared, a graying, round-faced man whose bulk strained his dark coat, followed by six fit-appearing younger men, each carrying a long cylindrical leather case.
"I brought all the maps of Altara I have, my lord," he told Talmanis in a musical accent as he bowed.
"Did everyone in these lands speak as if racing to get the words out?"
"Some cover the whole country, they do, some no more than 100 square miles. The best are my own, of course, those I made these past weeks."
"Lord Matt will tell you what he wants to see," Talmanis said. "Shall we leave you to it, Matt?"
But Toy was already telling the map-maker what he wanted, the map marked with the Seanchan camps. In short order it was sorted out from the others in one of the cases and spread on the ground, with Toy squatting on his heels beside it. Master Roydell sent one of his assistants running to fetch him a stool. He would have burst his coat buttons trying to imitate Toy, and likely have fallen over besides. Tuon stared at that map hungrily. How to get her hands on it? Exchanging glances and laughing as if being snubbed were the funniest thing in the world, Talmanis and the other three men strolled toward Tuon. The Aes Sedai gathered around the map on the ground until Toy told them to quit peering over his shoulder. They moved off a little, Bethamin and Sita healing them at a distance, and began talking quietly among themselves, occasionally glancing in his direction. If Toy had been paying any heed to their expressions, especially Jolene's, he might have been worried in spite of the incredible Tarangreal Mistress Annan said he carried. "We're about here, right?" he said, marking a spot with his finger. Master Roydell murmured that they were.
"So this is the camp where the Rakan supposedly is, the flying beast?" Another murmur of assent. "Good. What kind of camp is it? How many men are there?"
"Reportedly it's a supply camp, my lord, for resupplying patrols."
The young man returned with another folding stool, and the stout man eased himself down with a grunt.
"Supposedly about 100 soldiers, mostly Altaran, and about 200 laborers, but I'm told there can be as many as 500 more soldiers at times."
"A careful man, Master Roydell."
Talmanis made one of those odd bows with one foot forward, and the other three mirrored him.
"My lady," Talmanis said. "Vanin told me of your circumstances and the promises Lord Matt made. I just want to tell you he keeps his word."
"That he does, my lady," Adorian murmured. "Always."
Tuon motioned him to step aside so she could continue to watch Toy,
and he did so with a surprised glance at Toy and another for her. She gave him a stern look. The last thing she wanted was for these men to start imagining things. Not everything had fallen out as it had to, yet. There was still a chance this could all go awry.
"Is he a lord or is he not?" she demanded.
"Excuse me," Talmanis said. "But would you say that again? I apologize. I must have dirt in my ears."
She repeated herself carefully, but it still took them a minute to puzzle out what she had said.
"Burn my soul, no," Ryman said finally with a laugh. He stroked his beard. "Except to us. Lord enough for us."
"He dislikes nobles, for the most part," Carloman said. "I count it an honor to be among the few he doesn't dislike."
"An honor," Ryman agreed. Adorian contented himself with nodding.
"Soldiers, Master Roydell," Toy said firmly. "Show me where the soldiers are, and more than any few hundred."
"What is he doing?" Tuan said, frowning. "He can't think to sneak this many men out of Altara, even if he knows where every last soldier is. There are always patrols and sweeps by Rakan."
Again they took their time before answering. Perhaps she should try speaking very fast.
"We've seen no patrols in better than 300 miles, and no...
Rakan?
No Rakan," Adorian said quietly.
He was studying her. Too late to stop his imaginings. Ryman laughed again.
"If I know Matt, he's planning us a battle. The Band of the Red Hand rides to battle again. It's been too long, if you ask me."
Seleucia sniffed, and so did Mistress Annan. Tuan had to agree with them.
"A battle won't get you out of Altara," she said sharply.
"In that case," Talmanis said, "he's planning us a war."
The other three nodded agreement as if that were the most normal thing under the light. Ryman even laughed. He seemed to think everything was humorous.
3,000? Toy said. "You're sure?" "Sure enough, man. Sure enough will do. Vannin can locate them if they haven't moved too far."
Tuan looked at him, squatting there by the map, moving his fingers over its surface, and suddenly she saw him in a new light. A buffoon?
No.
A lion stuffed into a horse stall might look like a peculiar joke, but a lion on the high plains was something very different. Toy was loose on the high plains now. She felt a chill. What sort of man had she entangled herself with? After all this time, she realized, she had hardly a clue.
The night was cool enough to send a small shiver through Perrin whenever the breeze gusted despite his fur-lined cloak. A halo around the fat crescent moon said there would be more rain before long. Thick clouds drifting across the moon made the pale light dim and strengthen, yet it was enough for his eyes. He sat stepper just inside the edge of the trees and watched the cluster of 4 tall greystone windmills in a clearing atop the ridge, their pale sails gleaming and shadowed by turns as they rotated. The machinery of the windmills groaned loudly. It seemed doubtful the Shido even knew they should grease the works of the things. The stone aqueduct was a dark bar stretching east on high stone arches, past abandoned farms and rail-fenced fields, the Shido had planted too early with this much rain, toward another ridge and the lake beyond. Malden lay one more ridge west. He eased the heavy hammer in its loop on his belt. Malden and Fail. In a few hours he would add a 54th knot to the leather cord in his pocket. He cast his mind out. "Are you ready, Snowy Dawn?" he thought. "Are you close enough yet?" Wolves avoided towns, and with Shido hunting parties in the surrounding forest during the day, they stayed further from Malden than usual. "Patience, young bull," came the reply, touched with irritation. But then Snowy Dawn was irascible by nature, a scarred male of considerable age for a wolf who had once killed a leopard by himself. Those old injuries sometimes kept him from sleeping very long at a stretch. 2 days from now, you said. We will be there. Now let me try to sleep. We must hunt well tomorrow, since we cannot hunt the day after." They were images and smells, rather than words, of course, 2 days was the sun crossing the sky twice, and Hunt, a pack trotting with noses into the breeze, blended with the scent of deer. But Perrin's mind converted the images to words even as he saw them in his head. Patience, yes. Haste spoiled the work. But it was hard now that he was so close, very hard. A form appeared from the dark door at the base of the nearest windmill and waved an Aiel spear back and forth overhead. The groaning had convinced him the windmills must still be deserted. They had been when the maidens scouted them earlier, and no one would put up with that noise any longer than they had to. But he had sent Gaul and some of the maidens to be sure one way or another. "Let's go, Mishima," he said, gathering his reins. "It's done. One way or another."
"How can you make out anything?" the Shan Chan muttered.
He avoided looking at Perrin, whose golden eyes would be glowing in the night. That had made the scarred man jump the first time he saw it. He did not smell amused tonight. He smelled tense. But he called softly over his shoulder.
"Bring the carts ahead. Quickly now, quickly! And be quiet about it, or I'll have your ears."
Perrin heeled his dun stallion forward without waiting on the others, or the 6 high-wheeled carts. Liberally greased axles made them as quiet as carts could be. They still sounded noisy to him, the cart horses' hooves squelching in the mud, the carts themselves creaking as wood flexed and rubbed, but he doubted anyone else could have heard them 50 paces off, and maybe not closer. At the top of the gentle slope he dismounted and let Stepper's reins fall. A trained warhorse, the stallion would stand there as if hobbled so long as his reins hung down. The windmill heads squealed, turning slightly as the breeze shifted. The slowly spinning arms were long enough that Perrin could have touched one by jumping when it swung low. He stared toward the last ridge that hid Malden. Nothing grew there taller than a bush. Nothing moved in the darkness. Just one ridge between him and Fael. The maidens had come outside to join Gaul, all of them still veiled.
"There was no one," Gaul said, not quietly.
This close, the grinding of the windmill's gears would have swallowed quiet words.
"The dust has not been disturbed since I was here last," Sulin added.
Perrin scratched his beard, just as well. Had they needed to kill Shido, they could have carried away the bodies, but the dead would have been missed, and it would have drawn attention to the windmills and aqueduct. It might have started someone thinking about the water.
"Help me get the lids off, Gaul."
There was no need for him to do that. It would save only minutes, but he needed to be doing something. Gaul simply stuck his spear through the harness holding his bowcase to join the others on his back. The aqueduct ran along the ground on the ridgetop between the 4 windmills and stood shoulder-high on Perrin, less on Gaul, who climbed over. Just beyond the last pair of windmills, bronze handles on either side allowed them to lift off heavy pieces of stone 2 feet wide and 5 feet long until they cleared a stretch of 6 feet. What the opening was used for, he did not know. There was another like it on the other side, maybe to work on the flaps that made sure water flowed only one way, or to get inside to repair any leaks. He could see small ripples of motion as it streamed toward Malden, filling more than half the stone channel. Mishima joined them and dismounted to stand peering uncertainly at Sulin and the maidens. He probably believed the night hid his expression. He smelled wary now. He was followed quickly by the first of the red-coated Shonchan soldiers, scrambling up the muddy slope, each carrying 2 middling-sized jute sacks. Middling, but not heavy. Each contained only 10 pounds. Eyeing the Aiel suspiciously, the wiry woman set her sacks down and slashed one open with her dagger. A handful of fine, dark grains spilled on the muddy ground.
"Do that over the opening," Perrin said. "Make sure every grain goes into the water."
The wiry woman looked to Mishima, who said firmly,
"Do as Lord Perrin commands, Arata."
Perrin watched as she emptied the sack into the aqueduct, hands lifted over her head. The dark grains floated away toward Malden. He had dropped a pinch into a cup of water, hating to waste even that, and they took some time to absorb enough water to sink. Long enough to reach the big cistern in the town, he hoped. And if not, they could steep in the aqueduct itself. The cistern would still turn to fork root tea eventually. The light send it would be strong enough. With luck, maybe even strong enough to affect the Algaid Siswai. The wise ones who could channel were his target, but he would take any advantage he could gain. The light send did not grow strong faster than he expected. If those wise ones began staggering too soon, they might puzzle out the cause before he was ready. But all he could do was go ahead as if he knew exactly that and pray. By the time the second sack was being poured into the stone channel, the others began crowding up the slope. First came Seonid, a short woman holding her dark divided skirts up out of the mud. Shifting his attention from the maidens to her, Mishima made one of those small gestures to ward off evil. Strange that they could believe a thing like that worked. The soldiers lined up with their sacks, stared at her, wide-eyed for the most part, and shifted their feet. The Seonchan were none too easy about working with Aes Sedai. Her warders, Fjorn and Terrell, were at her heels, each with a hand resting on his sword hilt. They were just as easy about the Seonchan. The one was dark with gray streaking his curly black beard, the other fair and young with curled mustaches, yet they were alike as two beans, tall, lean, and hard. Rover Kirkland came a little behind them, a compact man with dark receding hair and a glum expression. He did not like being separated from Missouri. All three of the men had small bundles containing food strapped to their backs and fat water skins hanging from their shoulders. A lanky man rested his sacks on the side of the opening as the wiry woman headed downslope to fetch more. The carts were piled high with them.
"Remember," Perrin told Seonid, "the biggest danger will be getting from the cistern to the fortress. You'll have to use the guard walk on the wall, and there might be Shido in the town even at this hour."
Alice had seemed unsure on that. Thunder boomed hollowly in the distance, then again.
"Maybe you'll have rain to hide you."
"Thank you," she said icily.
Her moon-shadowed face was a mask of Aes Sedai serenity, but her scent spiked with indignation.
"I would not have known any of that if you had not told me."
The next moment her expression softened and she laid a hand on his arm.
"I know you are worried about her. We will do what can be done."
Her tone was not exactly warm, it never was, but not so chill as before, and her scent had mellowed to sympathy. Terrell lifted her up onto the edge of the aqueduct. The Seonchan emptying fork root into the thing, a tall fellow with almost as many scars as Mishima, nearly dropped his sack. And she grimaced faintly before swinging her legs over and lowering herself into the water with a small gasp. It must have been cold. Ducking her head, she moved out of sight toward Malden. Fjorn climbed in after her, then Terrell, and finally Rover. They had to bend sharply to fit under the roof of the aqueduct. Elias clapped Perrin on the shoulder before hoisting himself up.
"Should have trimmed my beard short like yours to keep it out of that," he said, gazing down at the water.
That graying beard, ruffled by the breeze, spread across his chest. For that matter, his hair, gathered at the back of his neck with a leather cord, hung to his waist. He carried a small bundle of food and a water skin, too.
"Still, a cold bath helps a man keep his mind off his troubles."
"I thought that was for keeping your mind off women," Perrin said. He was in no mood for joking, but he could not expect everyone to be as grim as he was.
Elias laughed.
"What else causes a man's troubles?"
He disappeared into the water, and Talanvor replaced him. Perrin caught his dark coat sleeve.
"No heroics, mind."
He had been of two minds about letting the man be part of this.
"No heroics, my lord," Talanvor agreed.
For the first time in a long time, he looked eager. The smell of him quivered with eagerness, but there was an edge of caution in it, too. That caution was the only reason he was not back in their camp.
I won't put Megden at risk, or the Lady Fael. I just want to see Megden that much quicker.
Perrin nodded and let him go. He could understand that. Part of him wanted to climb into the aqueduct, too, to see Fael again that much quicker. But every piece of the work had to be done properly, and he had other tasks. Besides, if he were actually inside Mulden, he was not sure how he could restrain himself from trying to find her. He could not catch his own scent, of course, but he doubted there was any caution in it now. The windmill heads turned again with loud squeaks as the wind shifted back. At least it never seemed to die up here. Any stoppage of the water flow would be disastrous. The ridgetop was becoming crowded now. 20 of Fael's hangers-on were waiting their turn at the aqueduct, all that remained save the two who were spying on Massima. The women wore men's coats and breeches and had their hair cut short except for a tail at the back in imitation of the Aiel, though no Aiel would have worn sword as they did. Many of the Tyran men had shaved their beards because Aiel did not wear them. Behind them, 50 Two Rivers men carried halberds and unstrung bows, their bowstrings safely tucked away inside their coats, and each with 3 bristling quivers tied to his back along with a parcel of food. Every man in the camp had volunteered for this, and Perrin had had to let them choose lots. He had considering doubling the number or more. Hangers-on and Two Rivers men had their bundles of food and their water skins. The constant flow of Shaunshan soldiers continued, carrying full sacks up the slope and empty sacks back down. They were disciplined. When a man slipped in the mud and fell, as happened with some regularity, there was no cursing or even mutters. They just got up and went ahead. Salon de Derengil, wearing a dark coat with 6 horizontal stripes of color across the chest, stopped to offer Perrin her hand. She only came up to his chest, but Elias claimed she handled the sword at her hip credibly. Perrin no longer thought she and the others were fools. Well, not all the time, in spite of their attempts to copy Aiel ways. With differences, of course. The tail of dark hair at Salanda's nape was tied with a length of dark ribbon. There was no fear in her scent, only determination. "Thank you for allowing us to be part of this, my lord," she said in precise Kyrianan accent. "We will not let you down, or the Lady Fael." "I know you won't," he said, shaking her hand. There had been a time when she had been pointed about serving Fael and not him. He shook the hand of every one of them before they climbed into the aqueduct. They all smelled determined. So did Ban Alcine, who commanded the Two Rivers men going into Mulden. "When Fael and the others come, wedge the outer doors shut, Ban." Perrin had told him this before, but he could not help repeating himself. "Then see if you can get them back up the aqueduct." That fortress had not kept the Shido out the first time, and if anything went wrong, he doubted it would keep them out this time either. He did not mean to renege on his bargain with the Shaunshan. The Shido were going to pay for what they had done to Fael, and besides, he could not leave them behind to continue ravaging the countryside. But he wanted her out of harm's way as soon as possible. Ban propped his bowstave and halberd against the aqueduct and hoisted himself up to reach a hand down inside. When he lowered himself back to the ground, he wiped his damp hand on his coat, then rubbed the side of his prominent nose.
"Below the water, it's coated with something feels like pond slime. We're going to have a hard enough time getting down that last slope without sliding the whole way, Lord Perrin, much less trying to climb it again. I expect the best thing is to wait in that fortress till you reach us."
Perrin sighed. He had thought of sending ropes, but they would have needed nearly 2 miles of it to span that last slope. A lot to be carried, and if any Shido spotted the butt end of it in the Mulden end of the aqueduct, they would search every nook and cranny in the town. A small risk, perhaps, yet the bitter loss that might result made it loom large.
"I'll be there as fast as I can, Ban. I promise you that."
He shook hands with every one of them, too. Lantern-jawed Todd Alcar, and Leof Torfin, with a white streak through his hair where a scar ran, given to him by Trollocs. Young Kenley Merrin, who was making a stab at growing a beard again, unfortunately. And Billy Adara, who was almost as white as Perrin, if a hand shorter. Billy was a distant cousin, and some of the closest kin Perrin had living. He had grown up with many of these men, though some were a few years older than he. Some were a few years younger, too. By now, he knew the men from down to Devon Ride and up to Watch Hill as well as he did those from around Emmons Field. He had more reason than Fail alone to reach that fortress as fast as he could. Had Alora, a lean fellow with thick mustaches like a Terrabanner, was the last of the Two Rivers men. As he climbed into the aqueduct, Gaul appeared, face still veiled and four spears gripped in the hand that held his bullhide buckler. He put a hand on the edge of the aqueduct and leapt up to sit on the stone coping.
"You're going in?" Perrin said in surprise.
"The maidens can do any scouting you need, Perrin Ibarra."
The big Aiel glanced over his shoulder toward the maidens. Perrin thought he scowled, though it was hard to be sure because of the black veil that hid all but his eyes.
"I heard them talking when they thought I was not listening. Unlike your wife and the others, Chiad is properly Gai Shain. Bane, too, but I care nothing about her. Chiad still has the rest of her year and a day to serve after we rescue her. When a man has a woman as Gai Shain or a woman a man, sometimes a marriage wreath is made as soon as white is put off. It is not uncommon. But I heard the maidens say they would reach Chiad first, to keep her from me."
Behind him, Sulin's finger flashed in maiden hand talk, and one of the others slapped a hand over her mouth as if stifling laughter. So they had been goading him. Maybe they were not so hard against his suit for Chiad as they pretended. Or maybe there was something Perrin was missing. Aiel humor could be rough. Gaul slipped into the water. He had to bend almost parallel to the surface to get under the aqueduct's top. Perrin stared at the opening. So easy to follow, Gaul. Turning away was hard. The line of Seanchan soldiers still snaked up and down the slope.
"Mishima, I'm going back to my camp. Grady will take you to yours when you're done here. Do what you can to blur the tracks before you go."
"Very well, my lord. I've told off some men to scrape grease from the axles and grease these windmills. They sound as if they could seize up any minute. We can do those at the far ridge, too."
Taking up Stepper's reins, Perrin looked up at the slow-turning sails. Slow, but steady. They had never been made to turn fast.
"And if Shido decide to come out here tomorrow and wonder where the fresh grease came from?"
Mishima regarded him for a long moment, his face half hidden by moon shadows. For once, he did not seem put off by glowing yellow eyes.
His scent... he smelled as if he saw something unexpected.
"The Banner General was right about you," he said slowly.
"What did she say?"
"You'll have to ask her, my lord."
Perrin rode down the slope and back to the trees, thinking how easy it would be to turn around. Galen could handle everything from here. It was all laid out. Except that the Mayenner believed every battle climaxed with a grand charge of horse. And preferably began with one, too. How long would he stick to the plan? Arganda was more sensible, but he was so anxious for Queen Aleandra that he might well order that charge as well. That left himself. The breeze gusted hard, and he pulled his cloak around him. Grady, elbows on his knees, was in a small clearing sitting on a half-worked mossy stone that was partially sunken into the ground and no doubt left over from building the aqueduct. A few others like it stood around. The breeze kept his scent from Perrin's nose. He did not look up until Perrin drew rein in front of him. The gateway they had used to come here still stood open, showing another clearing among tall trees not far from where the Seanchan were now camped. It might have been easier to have had them set up close to Perrin's camp, but he wanted to keep the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones as far from the Suldam and Damani as possible. He was not afraid of the Seanchan breaking Ty Lee's word, but the Aes Sedai and Wise Ones practically came down with the pip just thinking about Damani. Probably the Wise Ones and Anura would stay their hands for the time being. Probably. Masuri, he was not so sure of. In a number of ways. Better to keep a few leagues between them for as long as it could be managed.
"Are you all right, Grady?"
The man's weathered face seemed to have new lines in it. That might have been a trick of moon shadows cast by the trees, but Perrin did not think so. The carts had passed through the gateway easily, but was it a little smaller than the first he had seen Grady make?
"Just a little tired, my lord," Grady said wearily.
He remained seated with his elbows on his knees.
"All this traveling we've been doing lately. Well, I couldn't have held the gateway open long enough for all those soldiers to ride through yesterday. That's why I've taken to tying them off."
Perrin nodded. Both of the Ashaman were tired. Channeling took strength out of a man as surely as swinging a hammer all day at a forge. More so, in truth. The man with the hammer could keep going far longer than any Ashaman. That was why the aqueduct was the route into Maldon and not a gateway. Why there would be no gateway to bring Fael and the others out again, much as Perrin wished there could be. The two Ashaman only had so much more left in them until they could rest, and that little had to be used where it was needed most. Light, but that was a hard thought. Only if Grady Arnialt fell one gateway short of what was needed, a lot of men were going to die. A hard decision. "I'm going to need you and Niald the day after tomorrow." That was like saying he needed air. Without the Ashaman, everything became impossible. "You're going to be busy then." Another gross understatement.
"Busy as a one-armed man plastering a ceiling, my lord."
"Are you up to it?"
"Have to be, don't I, my lord?"
Perrin nodded again. "You did what had to be done."
"Send me back to our camp. After you return Mishima and his people to his, you and the maidens can sleep there if you'd like."
That would spare Grady a little against 2 days from now.
"Don't know about the maidens, my lord, but I'd as soon come on home tonight."
He turned his head to look at the gateway without rising, and it dwindled in the reverse of how it had opened. The view through it seemed to rotate as it narrowed, finishing with a vertical slash of silvery blue light that left a faint purplish bar in Perrin's vision when it winked out.
"Those Damani fair make my skin crawl. They don't want to be free."
"How would you know that?"
"I talked to some of them when none of those Suldam was close by. Soon as I brought up maybe they'd like those leashes off, just hinting-like, they started screaming for the Suldam. The Damani were crying and the Suldam petting them and stroking them and glaring daggers at me. Fair made my skin crawl."
Stepper stamped an impatient hoof, and Perrin patted the stallion's neck. Grady was lucky those Suldam had let him go with a whole hide.
"Whatever happens with the Damani, Grady, it won't be this week or next, and it won't be us who fixes it. So you let the Damani be. We have a job of work in front of us that needs doing."
"And a deal with the Dark One to do it." He pushed the thought away. Anyway, it had grown hard to think of Tali Kirgan being on the Dark One's side, or Mishima.
"You understand that?" "I understand, my lord. I'm just saying it makes my skin crawl."
At last another silvery blue slash appeared, widening into an opening that showed a clearing among large, widely spaced trees and a low stone outcrop. Leaning low on Stepper's neck, Perrin rode through. The gateway winked out behind him, and he rode on through the trees until he came to the large clearing where the camp lay, near what had once been the tiny village of Britain, a collection of flea-riddled hovels that the most rain-soaked night could not tempt a man into. The sentries up in the trees gave no warnings, of course. They recognized him. He wanted nothing so much as he wanted his blankets right then. Well, Fael certainly, but lacking her, he wanted to be alone in the dark. Likely he would fail to find sleep again, but he would spend the night as he had so often before, thinking of her, remembering her. Short of the 10-pace-wide thicket of sharpened stakes that surrounded the camp, though, he reined in. A rakan was crouched just outside the stakes, its long gray neck lowered so a woman in a hooded brown coat could scratch its leathery snout. Her hood hung down her back, revealing short-cropped hair and a hard, narrow face. She looked at Perrin as if she recognized him, but went right on scratching. The saddle on the creature's back had places for two riders. A messenger had come, it seemed. He turned into one of the narrow, angled lanes, through the stakes that had been left to allow horses through. Just not quickly. Most everybody had turned in already. He sensed movement on the horse lines, in the heart of the camp, likely some of the Kyrianan grooms or farriers, but the patched canvas tents and small huts of woven evergreen branches, now long since brown, lay dark and quiet. Nothing moved among the low Aiel tents, and only a few sentries walking up and down in the nearest Mayenner section of the camp. The Mayenners and Gael Danan put little trust in the two rivers men in the trees. His tall, red-striped tent was alight, however, and the shadows of a number of people shifted on the tent walls. When he climbed down in front of the tent, Athan Chandin appeared to take the reins and knuckle his forehead while he hunched a sort of bow. Athan was a good bow shot, or he would not have been here, but he had a truckling manner. Perrin went in unpinning his cloak.
"There you are,"
Berylaine said brightly. She must have dressed hastily because her long black hair looked as though it had just had a lick and a promise from a brush, but her high-necked gray riding dress appeared neat and fresh. Her serving women never let her don anything unless it was freshly ironed. She held out a silver wine cup for Brianna to refill from a long-necked wine pitcher, which the Kyrianan woman did with a grimace. Fael's maid disliked Berylaine with a passion. Berylaine seemed not to notice, though.
"Forgive me for entertaining in your tent, but the Banner General wanted to see you, and I thought I'd keep her company. She's been telling us about some white cloaks."
Balwer was standing unobtrusively in a corner. The bird-like little man could be as unnoticeable as a lizard on a branch when he wished to be, but his scent sharpened at the mention of white cloaks. Ty Lee, her shoulders straining a coat like that of the flyer, made a straight-legged bow while keeping one eye on Anura. She seemed to believe that Aes Sedai might turn into ravening wild dogs at any moment. Perrin thought she smelled of distress, though none showed on her dark face.
"My lord, I have two pieces of news I felt I had to bring you immediately. Have you begun putting the fork root into the town's water?"
"I have," he said worriedly, tossing his cloak down atop one of the brass-banded chests. Ty Lee sighed. "I told you I would. I'd have done it 2 days ago if that fool woman in Almazar hadn't dragged her heels so. What's happened?"
"Forgive me," Linny announced, "but I was roused from my blankets and I would like to return to them. Does anyone require anything else of me tonight?"
There were no curtsies or milords from the frail-appearing woman with her white hair in a loose braid for sleeping. Unlike with Berylaine, her brown dress looked hastily donned, unusual for her. Her scent was crisp and sharp with disapproval. She was one of those who believed the ridiculous tale that Perrin had slept with Berylaine on the very night after Fael had been captured. She managed to avoid looking at him while her gaze swept around the tent's interior. "I'll have some more wine," Aram announced, holding out his cup. Grim-faced and haggard in a red-striped coat, his eyes hollow, he was attempting to lounge in one of the folding camp chairs, but the sword strapped to his back made leaning against the gilt-edged back impossible. Brianna started toward him.
"He's had enough," Linny said sharply, and Brianna turned away.
Linny had a firm hand with Fael's servants. Aram muttered an oath and leaped to his feet, tossing his cup down on the flowered carpet that served as a floor. "I might as well go somewhere I won't have some old woman nagging at me every time I take a drink." He gave Perrin a sullen glare before stalking out of the tent, doubtless on his way to Massima's camp. He had pleaded to be one of the party sent into Malden, but his hot head could not be trusted with that.
"You can go, Linny," Berylaine said. "Brianna can look after us well enough."
A snort was the acknowledgement Linny gave. She made it sound almost delicate, before she stalked out, stiff-backed and reeking of disapproval. And still not looking at Perrin.
"Forgive me, my lord," Ty Lee drawled in careful tones, "but you seem to run your household more loosely than I'm accustomed to."
"It's our way, Banner General," Perrin said, picking up Aram's cup. "No need to dirty another. Nobody around here is property. If that sounded sharp, so be it." He had come to like Ty Lee after a fashion, but these Shonchan had ways that would make a goat gag. He took the pitcher from Brianna. She actually tried to hold on to it for a moment, frowning at him, as if she would deny him a drink, and poured for himself before handing it back. She snatched the pitcher out of his hand.
"Now, what happened? What about these white cloaks?"
"I sent Rockin out scouting as far as they could go just before dawn, and again just after sunset. One of the flyers tonight turned back sooner than expected. She saw 7,000 children of the light on the move not 50 miles from my camp."
"On the move toward you?"
Perrin frowned at his wine instead of drinking.
7,000 seems a very exact count to make in the dark."
"It seems these men, they're deserters," Anura broke in. "At least the Banner General sees them so."
In gray silk, she appeared as neat as if she had spent an hour dressing. Her thrusting nose made her look like a crow wearing beaded braids as she peered at Ty Lee, and the Banner General a particularly interesting bit of carrion.
She held a wine cup, but it seemed untouched. "I have heard rumors that Pedron Nile died fighting the Seanchan, but apparently Iman Valda, who replaced Nile, swore fealty to the Seanchan Empress."
Ty Lee mouthed, "May she live forever," under her breath. Perrin doubted anyone but himself heard. Balwer opened his mouth too, but closed it again without speaking. The white cloaks were a bugbear to him.
"Something over a month ago, however," the Grey Sister went on, "Galad Dumadred killed Valda and led 7,000 white cloaks to leave the Seanchan cause. A pity he became enmeshed with white cloaks, but perhaps some good has come of it. In any case, it appears there is a standing order that these men are all to be killed as soon as found. I have summed it up nicely, yes, Banner General?"
Ty Lee's hand twitched, as if it wanted to make one of those signs against evil.
"That's a fair summing up," she said.
To Perrin, not Anura. The Seanchan woman seemed to find speaking to an Aes Sedai difficult.
"Except the part about good coming of it. Oath-breaking and desertion can never be called good."
"I take it they're not moving toward you, or you'd have said."
Perrin put a hint of question into that, though there was no question in his mind.
"North," Ty Lee answered. "They're heading north."
Balwer half opened his mouth again, then shut it with a click of teeth.
"If you have advice," Perrin told him, "then give it. But I don't care how many white cloaks desert the Seanchan. Fael is the only thing I care about. And I don't think the Banner General will give up the chance to collar 300 or 400 more Damani to chase after them."
Berylaine grimaced. Anura's face remained smooth, but she took a long swallow of her wine. None of the Aes Sedai felt very complacent about that part of the plan. None of the wise ones did either.
"I will not," Ty Lee said firmly. "I think I'll take some wine after all."
Brianna took a deep breath before moving to comply, and a hint of fear entered her scent. Apparently the tall, dark woman intimidated her.
"I won't deny I would enjoy a chance to strike a blow at the white cloaks," Balwer said in that dry-as-dust voice. "But in truth I feel I owe this Galad Dumadred a debt of gratitude."
Perhaps his grudge was against this Valda personally.
"In any case, you have no need of my advice here. Events are in motion in Mulden, and if they weren't, I doubt you'd hold back even a day."
"Nor would I have advised it, my lord. If I may be so bold, I am quite fond of the Lady Fael."
"You may," Perrin told him. "Banner General, you said 2 pieces of news."
The Seanchan took the proffered wine cup from Brianna, and looked at him so levelly it was clear she was avoiding a glance at the others in the tent.
"May we speak alone?" she asked quietly.
Berylaine glided across the carpet to rest a hand on his arm and smile up at him.
"Anura and I don't mind leaving," she said.
Light, how could anyone believe there was anything between him and her? She was as beautiful as ever, true, yet the scent that had minded him of a hunting cat was so long gone from her smell that he barely remembered it.
The bedrock of her scent was patience and resolve now. She had come to accept that he loved Fail and only Fail, and she seemed as determined to see Fail freed as he was.
"You can stay," he said. "Whatever you have to say, Banner General, you can say in front of everyone here."
Tylee hesitated, glancing at Anura.
"There are two large parties of Aiel heading toward Mulden," she said at last, reluctantly. "One to the southeast, one to the southwest. The Morat Rakan estimate they could be there in 3 days."
Suddenly everything seemed to ripple in Perrin's sight. He felt himself ripple. Brianna gave a cry and dropped the pitcher. The world rippled again, and Berylaine clutched his arm. Tylee's hand seemed frozen in that odd gesture, thumb and forefinger forming a crescent. Everything rippled for a third time, and Perrin felt as if he were made of fog, as if the world were fog with a high wind coming. Berylaine shuddered, and he put a comforting arm around her. She clung to him, trembling. Silence and the scent of fear filled the tent. He could hear voices being raised outside, and they sounded afraid, too.
"What was that?" Tylee demanded finally.
"I don't know."
Anura's face remained serene, but her voice was unsteady.
"Light, I have no idea."
"It doesn't matter what it was," Perrin told them. He ignored their stares. "In 3 days, it will all be over. That's all that matters." Fail was all that mattered.
The sun stood short of its noonday peak, but Fail already felt harassed. The water for Savannah's morning bath, she bathed twice a day now, had not been hot enough, and Fail had been beaten along with everyone else, although she and Alejandra had only been there to scrub the woman's back. More than 20 wetlander Guy Shine had begged to be allowed to swear fealty just since sunrise. 3 had suggested rising up, pointing out that there were more Guy Shine in all these tents than Shido. They had seemed to listen when she pointed out that nearly all of the Aiel knew how to use a spear, while most of the wetlanders were farmers or craftsfolk. Few had ever held a weapon, and fewer still used one. They had seemed to listen, but this was the first day anyone had suggested such a thing right after swearing. Usually they took several days to work themselves around to it. The pressure was building, toward a slaughter unless she could thwart it. And now this.
"It is only a game, Fail Bashir," Roland said, towering over her as they walked along one of the muddy streets that wound through the Shido tents. He sounded amused, and a very small smile curved his lips. A beautiful man, to be sure.
"A kissing game, you said?" She shifted the lengths of striped toweling folded over her arm to draw his attention. "I have work to do, and no time for games, especially kissing games." She could see a few Aiel, several of them men staggering drunk even at this hour, but most of the people in the street were wetlanders wearing dirty Gaishine robes, or children splashing happily in the mud puddles left by the night's heavy rain. The street was thronged with men and women in mud-stained white carrying baskets or buckets or pots. Some actually went about chores. There were so many Gaishine in the camp that there really was not enough work to go around. That would not stop a Shido from ordering what were seen as idle hands to some work or other if those hands stuck out of white sleeves, however, even if it was make-work. To avoid having to dig useless holes in muddy fields, or scrub pots that were already clean, a good many of the Gaishine had taken to carrying something that made them look as if they were working. That did not help anyone avoid the real work, but it did help avert the other kind. Fail did not have to worry about that with most of the Shido, not so long as she wore those thick golden chains around her waist and neck, but the necklace and belt were inadequate for deterring wise ones. She had scrubbed clean pots for some of them, and sometimes had been punished for not being available when Savannah wanted her. Thus the toweling.
"We could start with a kissing game children play," he said, "though the forfeits in that are sometimes embarrassing. In the game adults play, the forfeits are fun. Losing can be as pleasant as winning."
She could not help laughing. The man certainly was persistent. Suddenly she saw Galena hurrying through the crowd in her direction,
holding her white silk robes up out of the mud, eyes searching avidly. Fail had heard the woman was allowed clothing again as of this morning. Of course, she had never been without the tall necklace and wide belt of gold and fire-drops. A cap of hair less than an inch long covered her head, and of all things a large red bow was pinned in it. It seemed unlikely that was by the woman's choice. Only a face Fail could not put an age to convinced her that Galena really was Aes Sedai. Beyond that, she was unsure of anything about her except the danger she presented. Galena spotted her and stopped dead, hands kneading her robes. The Aes Sedai eyed Rolon uncertainly. "I'll have to think on it, Rolon." She was not about to chase him away until she was sure of Galena. "I need time to think."
"Women always want time to think. Think on forgetting your troubles in the pleasure of a harmless game."
The finger he drew softly down her cheek before walking away made her shiver. To Aiel, touching someone's cheek in public was as much as a kiss. It surely had felt like a kiss to her. Harmless? Somehow she doubted that any game that involved kissing Rolon would end with just kissing. Luckily, she would not have to find out, or hide anything from Perrin, if Galena proved true. If. The Aes Sedai darted to her as soon as Rolon was gone. "Where is it?" Galena demanded, seizing her arm. "Tell me! I know you have it! You must have it!" The woman sounded almost pleading. Thurava's treatment of her had shattered that fabled Aes Sedai composure. Fail shook off her grip. "First, tell me again that you will take my friends and me with you when you go. Tell me straight out, and tell me when you are going." "Don't you dare talk to me that way," Galena hissed. Fail saw black flecks floating in her vision before she realized that she had been slapped. To her surprise, she slapped the other woman back as hard as she could, staggering her. She refrained from putting a hand to her stinging face, but Galena rubbed her own cheek, her eyes wide with shock. Fail steeled herself, perhaps for a blow with the power or something worse, but nothing happened. Some of the passing Guy Shine stared at them, but none stopped or even slowed. Anything that looked like a gathering of Guy Shine would draw Shido eyes and earn punishments for everyone involved. "Tell me," she said again. "I will take you and your friends with me," Galena practically snarled, snatching her hand down. "I leave tomorrow, if you have it. If not, Savannah will know who you are within the hour." Well, that was certainly speaking straight out. "It's hidden in the town. I'll get it for you now." But as she turned, Galena grabbed her arm again. The Aes Sedai's eyes darted, and she lowered her voice as if suddenly concerned about being overheard. She sounded frightened. "No, I'll take no chances on anyone seeing. You'll give it to me tomorrow morning, in the town. We'll meet there, in the south end of the town. I'll mark the building with a red scarf." Fail blinked. The southern half of Malden was a burned-out shell. "Why there?" she asked incredulously. "Because no one goes there, fool! Because no one will see us!" Galena's eyes were still darting. "Tomorrow morning, early. Fail me and you'll regret it." Gathering the skirts of her silk robe, she scurried away into the crowd. Fail frowned as she watched the woman go. She should have felt exultation, but she did not. Galena seemed almost a wild thing, unpredictable. Still, Aes Sedai could not lie. There seemed no way for her to wriggle out of her promise. And if she found one, there were still her own plans for an escape, though those seemed no further along, if much more dangerous, than they had when first begun. Which left Rolon and his kissing games. Galena had to prove true. She had to.